This program is originating in Washington.
Would you like to have a color photograph of the three Apollo 11 astronauts? We would be happy to send you one if you write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is the Voice of America. We'll return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
Mystery still surrounds the flight of Luna 15, the latest Soviet space probe. Sir Bernard Lovell, director of the Jodrell Bank Observatory, says the station is still in contact with the Soviet vehicle, but has no information regarding its intended mission. The Luna 15 is now in a low orbit around the moon, moving at times within 16 kilometers of its surface. Dr. Lovell suggested that the unmanned Soviet space vehicle may be trying to photograph the Americans on the moon. A report from Voice of America correspondent Wayne Hyde in Saigon says the entire cabinet of South Vietnam's premier, Tran Van Wong, has submitted its resignation to facilitate the setting up of a new administration. A government spokesman said the premier held a special session Monday morning and accepted the resignations of all of his ministers. However, the cabinet ministers will stay on the job until Premier Wong has chosen their replacements. South Vietnamese forces saw most of the combat action on Sunday and Monday and reported taking 107 enemy lives in scattered engagements. Correspondent Wayne Hyde in Saigon reports for VOA News.
The contacts took place in areas ranging from northernmost Quang Tri province to the Mekong Delta in the south. Overall, Vietnamese casualties were very light. A U.S. Marine Corps transport helicopter was shot down by enemy ground fire south of Da Nang on Sunday. 9 South Vietnamese soldiers died in the crash. 8 others were injured. One Marine crewman was also injured. U.S. forces reported only one ground action on Sunday southwest of the old city of Hue, and the bodies of 22 North Vietnamese troops were found near a bunker complex in Thai Nguyen province, apparently killed by airstrikes. Countrywide, there were 5 enemy shelling attacks during the past 24 hours that caused overall light casualties and damage. Wayne Hyatt, Voice of America, Saigon.
Egyptian and Israeli fighter planes attacked each other's ground positions across the Suez Canal yesterday for the first time since the 1967 war. Egypt said it knocked down 19 Israeli jets. Israel admitted losing 2 planes and said it shot down 5 Egyptian aircraft. The battle was touched off by an Israeli commando raid earlier across the canal on an Egyptian fortress. Israel said it held the fort for an hour, but Egypt said it repulsed the Israelis. Casualty reports conflict. Both sides see the fighting as a serious escalation. Reuters news agency quotes Israeli officials in Tel Aviv as saying the ceasefire between Israel and Egypt has become fiction. Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban met in Jerusalem yesterday with United States Ambassador to Israel, Walworth Barber. An Israeli official said Mr. Eban gave the ambassador his government's reaction to the recent Middle East talks in Moscow between Soviet officials and Assistant American Secretary of State Joseph Sisko. Israel has opposed the talks. The Council of the Organization of American States met in informal secret sessions early today in Washington. It meets again later today to consider reports from an OAS commission that is trying to enforce a ceasefire between El Salvador and Honduras. El Salvador has insisted that its troops will not leave Honduras until there are satisfactory guarantees for its people in Honduras. El Salvador also has accused Honduras of violating the OAS ceasefire that began Friday night. Honduras has denied the charge. The United States Senate will resume debate Tuesday on the controversial anti-ballistic missile proposal. The final week of debate will begin with the Senate still divided on the Nixon administration's proposal to deploy the defensive system designed to protect missile bases located in the United States. Democratic Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, the leader of the opposition forces, maintains that the vote will be extremely close, with the outcome in doubt until the final vote. Supporters of the system, called Safeguard, say it is necessary to protect America's missile force in the 1970s. America's former Vice President Hubert Humphrey met today with Premier Alexei Kosygin and said the Soviet leader told him the Soviet government is looking forward to cooperation with the United States. Mr. Humphrey, who was touring the Soviet Union as a private citizen, met for 2.5 hours with the Kremlin leader in Moscow. Radio and television stations throughout the Middle East Monday turned their attention to man's first walk on the moon. Lebanon, Egypt, Iraq, Kuwait, Jordan, all of the Arab world are following the progress of Apollo 11. Many regular programs are being interrupted for special bulletins. Radio Israel is giving priority to the event and is carrying special reports from their correspondents in the United States. Communist Cuba was the only country in the Western Hemisphere that did not join the radio television space network for the moon landing. That's the news from the Voice of America newsroom. This is John Cooley reporting.
This is the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. I'm Stuart Spencer in Washington. We take you now to Houston for a progress report from Jim Miller.
Well, all continues to go well as it reaches 118 hours and 34 minutes since Apollo 11 blasted off from Cape Kennedy last Wednesday. Right now, Aldrin and Armstrong, of course, are in the Eagle on the lunar surface. The reports here indicate that Armstrong is not sleeping as well as perhaps they had hoped for. The telemetry from the instrumentation in Neil's spacesuit says that he is at best dozing and perhaps sleeping a bit fitfully. Buzz Aldrin is not instrumented, so it's not possible to tell whether he is asleep or not. The people here do know that Mike Collins, on his 22nd revolution around the moon up in the spacecraft Columbia, does seem to be sleeping quite well. And the wake-up time for the Apollo 11 crew will be at 13 hours, 42 minutes Greenwich time. Among the thousands of visitors who have come into Houston for the Apollo 11 mission, I found three persons from Turkey who won an Apollo contest conducted by the newspaper Milliyet in Istanbul. They had a set of 15 questions to answer on the Apollo mission, and out of all of the persons who got them correctly, why, these three persons were selected and are here in Houston after having witnessed the launch of Apollo over in Cape Kennedy and are seeing the United States, of course, for the first time, and I would have to say under very auspicious and unusual circumstances. So all goes well with Apollo. We have not quite 3 hours yet to go before its wake-up time, and then, of course, at 12:55 Central Daylight Time, which will be 17:55 Greenwich Time, the next critical phase of this mission, when the ascent rocket will be fired and the redocking with Columbia in orbit will take place hours after that. That's the situation in Houston, and so we'll take you back to Washington.
Dr. William Pickering, director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, is one of the pioneers in the field of space exploration. Soon after Apollo 11 touched down on the moon, he was interviewed about the Apollo 11 mission and future interplanetary probes by correspondent Bill Stout of the Columbia Broadcasting System.
But Dr. Pickering certainly hasn't forgotten those long, long nights of waiting to find out about the first probe sent to the moon. How does it feel, Dr. Pickering, seeing what's happening up there today and thinking back to the early days of Ranger?
Well, of course, we lived through some of these landings on the moon with the Rangers and the Surveyors, and all the tension and all the excitement of the unmanned mission, of course, was accentuated manyfold when we knew that a man was bringing the spacecraft down as he did today. And so this was a most exciting day in the whole history of the program, there's no question about it.
You know, there's been an argument for years about manned versus unmanned, which is more efficient, more economical, and really it's an argument that's almost revived today with the mystery of Luna 15 circling the moon at the same time Apollo is there. Does it seem to you, sir, that that whole dispute has become completely irrelevant with the landing?
I think it's irrelevant because there are always things for man to do and there are things for instruments to do. The instruments of the early unmanned probes have paved the way for the Apollo. They've shown us shown us how to navigate to the moon. We've shown what the surface of the moon actually looks like. We've got a good idea of what it's going to be like when Armstrong steps out on the moon in a few minutes. And this has all been an essential part of the total development. And if we look ahead, we can see that the exploration of the moon will require both manned and unmanned devices. There are going to be parts of the moon which are going to be very difficult to get to with a manned vehicle. And these we expect will be explored with unmanned devices. Man, however, will certainly be a key part of the exploration. And as a matter of fact, of course, when we talk about unmanned spacecraft, we have to remember that really there's a man involved. The man may be sitting down here on the Earth instead of in the spacecraft, but the sorts of devices which are being flown nowadays are complex devices with command capabilities, with control capabilities, and a man must somewhere be making those decisions. And so we have manned and unmanned devices working together to explore space.
You have some unmanned devices, to use your word, coming up very shortly, Mariners to Mars.
We do indeed.
What do you expect from them?
We expect to get some very good photographs, or at least, shall we say, much better photographs of Mars than anything we have seen so far. We expect to photograph the entire disk of the planet in much better detail than we can see it from Earth, and we also expect to get some close-up pictures of the planet, which will be very much better than anything we've seen before.
Could we come close, do you think, in these two Mariner missions to answering the two old nagging questions about the canals and whether there's life on Mars?
I think we ought to answer the question about the canals, because if the canals can be seen from Earth, they will certainly be seen in our photographs. On the question of life on Mars, that's another question. I think to really answer that, we'll have to get down to the surface. This, of course, we hope to do in a few years.
You think that's the next step in unmanned exploration?
The unmanned exploration of Mars is going to go through a mission in about two years. In 1971, we will go into orbit around the planet and make some really detailed examination of the planet. And then in 1973, we'll come down to the surface and begin the real surface exploration of the planet, which will be necessary before we can answer that question about life. And I personally happen to think that question about life on Mars is indeed one of the most fascinating questions which we can ask in the whole era of space exploration.
You think we can answer it that soon? Hmm?
We're not going to necessarily get an answer in 73, but that is the first step.
It may seem crass, Dr. Pickering, to put a question in competitive terms on this day when the feeling is one of overwhelming emotion, but do you think, considering again Luna 15, that the Russians are ahead of us in the unmanned area? They've done so much of it so far out in space.
The Russians have, of course, had a very active unmanned program, both to the moon and to the planets. The Russians have not landed anything on the moon yet, and of course Surveyor has landed successfully. There are five Surveyors sitting on the moon, one of them not so very far away from Tranquility Base. And on the other hand, in the planets, the exploration of the planets, the Russians have sent probes into the atmosphere of Venus. So I would say that both of us have had an active program. In some areas, they're ahead of us. In other areas, we're ahead of them.
Do we share a great deal of this information?
The scientific information does get shared in international discussions.
Dr. William Pickering, director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, as interviewed by Bill Stout of the Columbia Broadcasting System. We have in our studio Mr. Merle Waugh, director of program control in the Advanced Manned Missions Program Office of NASA. Merle, I'd like to ask you, there have been references now to Armstrong and Aldrin sleeping, ostensibly, in the lunar module. What are the facilities for sleeping?
I would say that facilities for sleeping are minimal in the LAM. The LAM, of course, was designed for a very particular job, to land on the lunar surface. The spacecraft cabin is laid out for that job, and there's absolutely no provisions along the lines we think of for sleeping for the astronauts. It's more like if you got caught in your car in a thunderstorm and you had to wait it out. You'd sort of have to be sitting there straddling your controls and your feet up on the dashboard or something like that. They have the other disadvantage compared to the command module in that they are under the influence of the Earth or of the moon's gravity, 1/6 G, so they are being forced down against the spacecraft floor, where in contrast Collins is essentially in a weightless condition and has nothing to bother him that way.
Are they in a sitting position?
Well, I believe that the plan was, and these astronauts are varying the plan a little bit according to the immediate situation, was to place themselves such that their feet were sort of up on the dashboard, so they get the upper part of their body flat down on the surface and make themselves comfortable. But I presume that's what they're doing. I would say that the problem of Armstrong and maybe Aldrin too not being asleep is perhaps one of being excited and taking a while to calm down rather than anything else.
Rather than any actual discomfort.
Right.
In spite of the fact that, as you point out, the facilities are minimal. Installations in Australia played a key role in transmitting television pictures from the moon to the Earth, and VOA correspondent Robert Chancellor has that report.
Advancement of the extravehicular activity by the men on the moon nearly cheated Australia of its moment in history, but delays in the various checkouts before man stepped out of the Eagle moonship finally saved the spot for this nation. And as planned, it was a tracking facility or radio telescope in Australia that provided the television pictures of Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin on the moon. The television relay worked perfectly. A corner of the Overseas Telecommunications Center in Sydney was the switching point for the lunar TV. On screens side by side were pictures from the 210-foot or 70-meter radio telescope at Parkes and the 85-foot or 25-meter tracking dish at the Honeysuckle Creek Tidbinbilla complex. There was no comparison. Technicians described the Honeysuckle pictures as adequate for broadcast, but the Parkes pictures were excellent. Engineers said they were far clearer and much sharper than they had expected. The Parkes pictures were sent to the United States. Once acquired, mission controllers never departed from that Parkes transmission. In the early minutes of the telecast, however, before the Parkes antenna moved into view of the moon, video had been provided alternately by Honeysuckle Creek and by the Goldstone, California tracking station, both NASA-owned and operated facilities. Parkes is not NASA-owned and operated. It's a deep space radio astronomy device being used for the first time in manned space missions. From Parkes, the television pictures were sent 400 kilometers east to Sydney. There, in a little heralded part of the procedure, they were converted from a 300-line slow scan signal to a commercial quality picture. The pictures coming from the moon had only 1/6 the number of exposures as normal television. The scan converter basically recorded each frame or picture and then played back each recording 6 times before starting on the next frame. That process is the reason why quick movements by the astronauts sometimes seemed blurred. From Sydney, the television pictures were transmitted via communication satellite to the United States and then relayed to the viewing public of the world. Australians, meanwhile, received their picture directly from the Sydney Switching Center. Thus, they saw each historic movement a fraction of a second before the rest of the world. This is Robert Chancellor, Voice of America, at Sydney Video.
The lunar module has been on the surface of the moon now 16 hours and 2 minutes. And millions of people around the world are following the progress of Apollo 11 and the astronauts on the moon. And, of course, international communications networks are involved. And our correspondent in Tokyo, Walter Sheldon, reports on Japan's role in this process.
First it was cameras, then transistor radios, then all sorts of electronic equipment. By making high-quality products in these and other fields, Japan became a leading industrial nation. And Japan's communications facilities are now playing a major role in spreading the information that comes from the Apollo 11 project. Japanese technical resources are bringing this information not only to Japan itself, but to other parts of the world. We talked to Mr. Yoichi Inoue, an official of a company known as Kokusai Denshin Denwa, Japan's equivalent of the International Telephone and Telegraph Corporation. This company, KDD, sets up all the channels for electronic communication to and from Japan and within the country. Planning for Apollo 11 coverage began some months ago in Japan, but at the last minute, an additional task was laid on. As Mr. Inoue explains...
Well, you understand, the 30th June, Intelsat 3rd Flight 2 was inferior, suddenly inferior, and they could not make a TV transmission over the Atlantic between United States and Europe. So the all TV transmission should be rerouted via Japan from Europe to United States or United States to Europe.
So far, Japanese technical facilities have been doing the job without a hitch. In addition to relaying broadcasts between the United States and Europe, Japanese communications channels are serving the millions of TV and radio sets within Japan.
Also, we receive over 100 TV transmission requests from Japanese broadcasters, including the BBC and European Broadcasting Union's requirements. We work for the six Japanese TV networks in Tokyo, and also we work for the four key Japanese radio networks and three big press agencies, including American press agencies.
It has been estimated that one out of every four people in the world will see some part of Apollo 11 on TV. In Japan, the proportion is undoubtedly even higher. Japanese power companies report that at the time of the launching of Apollo 11, which came shortly after 10 in the evening, Japan time, rural power stations reported a sudden, unexpected heavy load as TV sets all over the country were turned on. Fortunately, there were no power failures, although the system was strained almost to the breaking point. Meanwhile, bars and coffee shops, nearly all of which have color television sets, report a booming business during highlight periods of the moon mission. There has even been a last-minute rush to buy color TV sets, which sell at around $400 apiece. When I spoke with Mr. Inoue of the Japanese Communications Corporation, I said...
Mr. Inoue, how do you personally feel about the Apollo 11 mission? Are you excited?
Yes, it was an exciting date for our life, for my life. But I understand Apollo 11... project is one of the climax of the human technology. We should support everything for such plans in the world.
Walter Sheldon, Voice of America, Tokyo.
And now with a report on Apollo 11 reaction in Hong Kong, here is VOA's Ian Stewart.
A Hong Kong television station woke viewers at 5 a.m. local time this morning with the tune Fly Me to the Moon, just in time to give them a first-hand account of the lunar module touchdown. The Apollo 11 astronauts in Eagle landed on the moon at 5:17 a.m. local time. The station had advised viewers to leave their sound on overnight so they could be awakened. Hong Kong's two radio stations stayed open throughout the night to bring listeners up-to-the-minute details on the moon mission, and one station relayed the Voice of America's report of the landing without interruption until its scheduled morning program began. Many residents woke early to follow the landing. A pre-dawn jogger carrying a transistor radio called out to another early riser, "They've landed." The space fleet has been so well publicized here that nobody could be in doubt about to whom he was referring. The landing and subsequent moonwalk was the featured story in all major papers and in the news reports of radio and television stations, which gave more airtime to the mission than to any past event. The coverage here contrasted strikingly with the total news blackout on the event in communist China. Peking has ignored the Apollo 11 mission as it has kept silent about previous space flights over the past few years. Some news of the event will trickle into communist China, but millions of people in remote areas will not know that man has landed on the moon. This is Ian Stewart, Voice of America, Hong Kong.
The Apollo 11 astronauts now on the surface of the moon are resting, ostensibly, after a day of tension and achievement, and in preparation for another day of challenge. The blast-off from the moon's surface will be crucial. The lunar excursion module must succeed in rejoining the Apollo command module as it orbits the moon if the two moonwalkers are to return safely to Earth. For a preview of the launch from the moon's surface, here is VOA's Morris Joyce.
The lunar module is a unique spacecraft in many respects, not the least of which is that it carries its own launch pad. The descent stage of the vehicle, containing the rocket engine that guided it down to the lunar surface, will serve also as the launch pad when astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin leave the moon. As the time for the blast-off approaches, Neil Armstrong will set a number of control switches to initiate a sequence of stage separation. At the proper moment, these switches will activate the explosive nuts and bolts holding the lunar module's ascent and descent stages together. The precise moment of blastoff is determined by the position of the Apollo command module, piloted by Michael Collins. It will be in orbit around the moon, waiting for Armstrong and Aldrin. The spacecraft must be at a predetermined point in its orbit when the lunar module leaves the moon. Otherwise, the two vehicles cannot rendezvous and dock with each other. According to present plans, the lunar module is to lift off from the moon at 17 hours 50 minutes Greenwich Mean Time on Monday, July 21st. At that time, the astronauts will ignite the 1,600 kilogram thrust rocket engine that will launch them on the return journey from the lunar surface. The lunar module will climb straight up for 14 seconds at a speed of about 95 kilometers an hour. Then, using the smaller attitude control rockets, the astronauts will change the direction of the vehicle to a 52-degree angle, with the main rocket still firing. It will burn for an additional 7 minutes, increasing the speed to about 6,500 kilometers an hour, sufficient to put the spacecraft into an egg-shaped orbit. The low point of this orbit will be about 18 kilometers above the lunar surface, with the high point approximately 80 kilometers. The returning astronauts will remain in this orbit until the time comes to begin the complicated rendezvous maneuver prior to docking with the Apollo 11 command module. This is Morris Joyce.
The lunar module has now been on the surface of the moon some 16 hours, 11 minutes, and 10 seconds. And we're approaching, of course, with each minute, time for blastoff. And we want to ask Merle Waugh if he feels that the blastoff from the moon will be as critical as was the landing on the part of the lunar module.
Well, the landing was a very unique event in the mission because it required the astronauts' participation and so forth. But you could have terminated that if that particular part of the mission if you had any trouble by firing your ascent engine and going back into orbit. The liftoff that's coming up now, I think, is much more critical because it has to occur.
Thank you, Merle. The Voice of America's continuing coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. This program is originating in Washington. We will return to our live Voice of America coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of Late World News.
The critical link-up with the command ship Columbia orbiting the moon is the next task awaiting American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin following their highly successful exploration of the lunar surface. The two moonwalkers are now resting in their landing craft. During their 2-hour, 40-minute exploit on the lunar surface, they scooped up about 50 pounds of rocks and other material for later examination. They also carried out a number of scientific experiments. An estimated 500 million persons around the world watched the astronauts on live television. However, viewers in Moscow were limited to a 7-minute film of the walk on the moon, as the Soviet Union gave little play in its news to the Apollo 11 mission. In other world news, the Council of the Organization of American States meets today in Washington to consider reports of the ceasefire between quarreling Central American neighbors Honduras and El Salvador. An Egyptian official terms Sunday's intense Israeli-Egyptian fighting along the Suez Canal a very serious escalation of the simmering Mideast conflict. Egypt claims shooting down 19 Israeli airplanes, while Israel confirms 2 were downed. In South Vietnam, the current fighting lull continues, and American air attacks were carried out against Viet Cong areas near the Cambodian border. Meanwhile, Voice of America correspondent Wayne Hyde reports the resignation of South Vietnamese Premier Tran Van Wong's entire cabinet. In Italy, Premier-designate Mariano Rumor continues his search for a coalition cabinet to replace his center-left coalition that collapsed 2 weeks ago. West Berlin reports that an East German border guard has escaped unnoticed to the west. And Britain and Brazil have advanced to the Davis Cup Interzone Tennis Finals later this month at Wimbledon. That's the news from the Voice of America newsroom. This is John Cooley reporting.
This is the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. History has been made, of course, with the successful landing and walking of man on the moon. Here is the way it happened when we on Earth saw the first shadowy television pictures taken on the moon, pictures of man in the person of astronaut Neil Armstrong taking the first step on the lunar surface. VOA correspondent Rhett Turner describes the event.
TV circuit breaker's in.
Buzz saying he's got the TV circuit breaker in. Turning on the camera.
Roger.
Here we go. Now we can see a picture from the moon.
TV.
Picture of the TV.
You got a good picture, huh? There's a great deal of contrast in it, and currently it's upside down on our monitor, but we can make out a fair amount of detail.
Here are the first live pictures from the surface of the moon. We can see some movement there.
Okay, would you clarify the position, opening I ought to have on the camera?
It's upside down. They've had to turn it around. They've had to reverse the picture. Neil has stepped down. He's now down on the foot pad. Armstrong's foot is on the foot pad.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
It's very dark.
We can see. I just checked this. Getting back up to that first step, it's not even collapsed too far, but it's adequate to get back up. Roger, we copy. It's a pretty good little jump.
He wants to check how hard it is to get back up to that first step. It's quite a reach. He has a foot down on the foot pad. We can't tell if he stepped off onto the surface
yet. This is Houston, F2, 1/160th second. For shadow photography on the sequence camera.
It's a silhouetted picture. It's very
at
difficult
the foot of the
to
ladder,
see.
The lamp footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be
as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Down there, it's very fine.
Armstrong is standing on the footpad. We can see him moving around now. He is undoubtedly.
I'm going to step off the land now.
He's stepping off. He has put his left foot off on the surface of the moon. Man is
That's
on the moon.
One small step for man. One giant leap for mankind.
One small step for man, one giant leap for man. Neil Armstrong's first words on the surface of the moon.
Correspondent Rhett Turner describing the first television pictures taken on the surface of the moon, of the surface of the moon, among other things. Shortly after spacewalking astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin set foot on the moon, a voice at Mission Control in Houston asked the pair to stand together near the American flag and then told them that they'd had a telephone call from the President of the United States.
Neil and Buzz, the President of the United States is in his office now and would like to say a few words to you, over.
That would be an honor.
Go ahead, Mr. President. This is Houston out.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made. I just can't tell you how proud we all are of what you... For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. And for people all over the world, I am sure they too join with America in recognizing what an immense feat this is. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world. And as you talk to us from the Sea of Tranquility, it inspires us to redouble our efforts to bring peace and tranquility to Earth. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this Earth are truly one. One in their pride in what you have done, and one in our prayers that you will return safely to Earth.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's a great honor and privilege for us to be here representing not only the United States, but man of peace of all nations. And with interest and a curiosity and with a vision for the future. Honor for us to be able to participate here today.
And thank you very much, and I look forward, all of us look forward to seeing you on the Hornet on Thursday.
Look forward to that very much, sir.
That was a conversation between moonwalkers Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and President Richard Nixon, who spoke in the longest, long-distance telephone call that has ever been placed. The lunar module has now been on the surface of the moon 16 hours and 22 minutes. The Eagle's astronauts will leave a number of objects on the lunar surface, some as reminders of man's first trip to the moon and others for space experiments. One such experimental device that was left is a laser reflector. Its purpose was discussed in an interview by VOA's Rhett Turner with Dr. Wilmot Hess, Director of Science and Applications at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
Dr. Hess, I think one of the most interesting scientific pieces of apparatus to be left on the moon is this laser reflector. And it's a little hard for those of us on Earth to understand how many things and how many important aspects of scientific experimentation can be conducted with this. Would you explain them for us?
Yeah, this is a very neat experiment. It's also very simple. What you do is just take some very accurately machined corners of high-quality quartz glass. And a corner, I mean a three-sided thing, which has the property that if you put light into it, the light comes back in exactly the same direction you put it into it. And the same thing is used in radar, where they talk about a corner reflector for radar. Well, what this means then, you put this very nice reflector on the surface of the moon, you shine a laser beam from the Earth on this reflector, and you get a signal back from the reflector just at the place where you had the laser beam come from. Now, not exactly that place, but very close to it.
It is extreme accuracy, though, isn't it?
Yes, with a laser beam, with a very finely divided signal and timing it very accurately, we can measure the distance to the moon much more accurately than it's known now. And more interesting than just the distance to the moon, we can measure the detailed motions of the moon. Now, that gives us some lead-ins to various areas of science that we now can't handle.
How accurately? Within a few centimeters?
We can measure changes in the distance to the moon to about 10 or 20 centimeters if we range this thing for a period of a year or so. It takes a long time to sort out all the problems on it. But that isn't to say we'll know the exact distance to the moon to 10 centimeters, but we would be able to tell if the moon were 10 centimeters farther away or closer to us than that.
A differential.
Yes, exactly, the differential distance. Well, this starts you into the business of being able to understand the detailed motions of the moon. The moon doesn't keep exactly its same face to us all the time. It librates. It nods at its head, and it nods yes, and it nods no. And you can try to sort out these two separate motions, these librational motions in latitude and longitude. And this can tell you something very important. It tells you how much out of round the moon is, what its moments of inertia are around its three principal axes. And this says something about the shape of the moon that we don't know in detail now. This isn't something that can be accurately enough measured from Earth to understand the properties of the inside of the moon. In fact, a year ago, we were in a pretty awkward situation that the information we had in hand led one to believe the moon was hollow. Now, that just says that the information isn't very good, and we are convinced the moon isn't hollow. But it also says we've got to do a better experiment to find out what the internal density distribution of the moon is. This experiment can help us. But it does other things also. For instance, it can start telling us about the detailed motion of the Earth. An example of that, if you put one of these laser reflectors in South America and also one in Africa, you might find that they give you a little bit different information. And that different information might say that the laser station in South America was moving away from the laser station in Africa, as we think is the case now because of continental drift. There's information from the ocean floor spreading that says that the Atlantic Mid-Atlantic Ridge is a site where motion both eastward and westward is being accomplished so that South America is moving farther away from Africa. Now, that's rather indirect evidence so far, and here's a chance of actually measuring how far away Africa and South America are as they change in time.
I understand that there are methods of testing some of the theories of relativity from this device.
Yes, there's one of the theories of relativity by Dickey of Princeton that says that the gravitational constant is not a constant, but it's changed with time. That big G, the strength that one celestial object pulls on another object, is variable. Now, if in fact it's variable, and variable at the amount that Dickey suggests, one should be able to see this in the change in the motion of the moon with respect to the Earth over a period of several years. If we're able to range on this corner on the moon for a long time, we have the chance of measuring that change in the gravitational constant, which may or may not be true. It's only a theory.
Is this concerned with the theories of an expanding or contracting universe?
Well, it would have to do with models of the universe, because if G does change in time, that would change how the universe has evolved. But it wouldn't change the general idea that there's an expanding universe. It would change in detail how it is expanded.
Dr. Hess, thank you very much for explaining this exciting device called the laser reflector to be left on the moon during Apollo 11. Dr. Wilmot Hess, Director of Science and Applications at the Manned Spacecraft Center. This is Rhett Turner.
Among the experiments slated for last night was the collection of a contingency sample of the material of the moon's surface, which, according to the program, was to be the first function that Neil Armstrong was to perform upon stepping on the surface of the moon. There was a little human interest involved in that he did not do that. He took his camera and took some pictures first. I'd like to ask Merle Waugh If this was particularly important, his divergence or his not following the schedule, so to speak.
Well, I'm not sure what flexibility he was really supposed to have, but it's been my observation that the first thing the most important thing that I'd like to get back when I'm thinking about exploring a place is a picture of it. And I'm not quite sure what Armstrong took pictures of prior to the time where he picked up his contingency sample, but they could very well have been very important too. But if I were he, I would have followed the procedure, but he must have had some reason for taking these pictures first.
Merle, let me ask you, of course at Houston they have information we don't have here in Washington, but to the best of your knowledge, were all of the scheduled experiments performed?
As far as I know, all the experiments were performed, or at least deployed. Of course, the experiments will be performed over a long period of time after they leave the surface. The only thing I'm not sure was deployed is this auxiliary TV transmitting antenna, and I gather that it was not necessary to deploy that because communications were so good through the LEM spacecraft systems.
Reaction to the epic flight of Apollo 11 has come from nearly every corner of the world. And with a look at South Vietnam's views, here now is VOA Saigon correspondent Wayne Hyde.
South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu sent a message of congratulations to President Nixon, the American people, and the astronauts, referring to the moon landing as a new frontier of human beings. The message ended with a hope for the complete success and safe return of the astronauts and for further successes in American space endeavors. And Vice President Nguyen Cao Ky said, "I have a very great admiration for the three American astronauts. I am sure their families and the American people are very proud of them." Asked if he'd like to trade places with Neil Armstrong, the Vice President jet pilot laughed and said, "Yes, yes, yes. I want to go to the moon before I become too old." Scientists, religious leaders, entertainers, everyone had a comment on the moon flight. One science writer who 2 years ago visited Cape Kennedy told Voice of America the landing and moonwalk was, in his opinion, the greatest scientific achievement the world has ever known. The director of Vietnam Press, the government's official news agency, said he had never doubted for a moment that American astronauts would make it safely to the moon. One of South Vietnam's most famous singers said she has been singing songs about the moon for years, but if she were there right now, she said, she would sing what she called a song of peace to the astronauts. And a Catholic priest told Voice of America that the landing and the walk on the moon was what he called the priceless result of science and a complete faith in God. This is Wayne Hyde, Voice of America in Saigon.
16 hours and 31 minutes now the lunar module has been on the surface of the moon. What does the flight of man to the moon mean for the future? That question has been answered in many different ways by scientists, philosophers, and national leaders. One of the most interesting points of view comes from early science fiction writers, those men who were the first to imagine interplanetary space travel and to write about it. Arthur Clarke began writing about space travel in the 1930s and most recently completed a futuristic space movie, 2001. He spoke about his views on the future of man in space in an interview with Columbia Broadcasting System newsman Walter Cronkite.
I think the first order priority is the establishment of an economical space transporter so that we can establish a large space station which would act as an astronomical observatory, which will tell us a very great deal about Mars and the other planets before we get there, because then with large telescopes in space near the Earth, we'll learn a great deal about these places. And also, from the space station, in the space station, we can develop the techniques of long-range space exploration.
Arthur, you've been dreaming of this moment long before many of us did, beginning back in the mid-1930s. You were writing about going out to the moon. What was your feeling when we saw this thing happen today?
Well, I don't think I did feel anything. I think we all sort of, the time just stopped to me, and I think it stopped for everybody. It was just a hole in history, you know, and the whole world's everything. My heart stopped, breathing stopped.
Mine certainly did, and I think all of ours did. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I can't imagine a moment to equal this. The only thing I could imagine is if some fellow came forward and could say positively, we're not going to have any more war.
I think this is a step in that direction, because this sort of thing is making our stupidities here on Earth seem more and more intolerable. And I think this may be the greatest result of the space program.
Longtime space writer Arthur Clarke commenting on the future and the meaning of man in space. Even more enthusiastic about the moon landing is another space author, Robert Heinlein. Columbia Broadcasting System newsman Robert Stout interviewed Mr. Heinlein, who wrote one of the first books about space travel.
It's been thought about for... Well, the first novel written about the a trip to the moon was not written by me. It was written by Cyrano de Bergerac a long, long time ago.
Nonetheless, you were far ahead, and you were talking in your book about nuclear power as the means of getting there.
Yes, nuclear power. We will be using nuclear power in spaceships. This is a certainty. We're going to go on bigger, farther, but I think this whole business today, this week, has been thought of in many cases in too small terms. Today is New Year's Day of the year one.
The lunar module has now been on the surface of the moon some 16 hours and 34 minutes. Merle Waugh, in terms of hours, Merle, can you hear me? In terms of hours, how far are we now from the attempted blastoff?
The blastoff is scheduled for 1:55 p.m. our time here. Now, I don't know what that means in terms of the other time scales, but that's about 5 hours from now.
5 hours from now. And as we discussed earlier, this could potentially be the most critical maneuver in the entire mission.
Definitely.
Thank you, Merle. In the biggest city of the United States, the biggest crowds collected in the city's biggest park. Robert Radin reports.
The biggest crowd in New York Sunday night was gathered in the sheep meadow of Central Park. An estimated 50 to 60,000 persons, most of them under 30, watched one of three huge television screens set up by the three large United States television networks. All three, by no coincidence, offered their version of man's landing on the moon. The crowd cheered when Neil Armstrong's foot touched the moon's surface. Buzz Aldrin got a similar ovation, and so did the placement of the flag of the United States on the moon. An unsuccessful attempt at the park to send a man aloft in a hot air balloon provided a momentary distraction. Many in the park left after the two astronauts had safely landed. As one man told his wife, "We'll watch the rest of it at home." Several salesmen were offering pennants for sale with the words "Men on the Moon," and another was peddling early souvenir editions of the Daily News. A girl interviewed by one of the TV networks drew a cheer when she said, "The moon landing will bring the American people closer together." Rain clouds over New York obscured a view of the moon and for an hour or so drizzled on the crowd. But the television pictures here were excellent, and so were the spirits of the people who viewed history in the making from the moon. This is Robert L. Radin, Voice of America, in New York's Central Park.
A little earlier on, Rhett Turner talked to Dr. Wilmot Hess about one of the experiments on the surface of the moon, the laser reflector. The samples collected by Armstrong and Aldrin will be briefly evaluated in the Houston Receiving Laboratory by a staff headed by Dr. Wilmot Hess before being turned over to other scientists. Some weeks ago, Rhett Turner asked Dr. Hess to explain the details of that scientific operation.
Dr. Hess, you've been guiding what promises to be one of the most exciting eras in science, and that is the retrieval of material from the moon and scientific investigation of the moon. Here at the Manned Spacecraft Center, you've had quite a job for the last few years in pulling all of the elements together, haven't you?
Yes, the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, which will be the focus of this kind of business, is a very peculiar lab, and we've had our share of problems in putting that thing on the air. It's a quite unique laboratory. It combines the best low-level radiation counting facility in the world with a biological processing, which is unique to anything I've known anything about, where we take lunar material and feed that material to germ-free mice and expose it to various kinds of plants and see what their reaction to this material is. And also, this laboratory has in it, I think, the only vacuum system in the world where a man working in astronaut gloves can be working in a very, very good vacuum, not as good as the surface of the moon, but one of the best ones we can get on Earth, to work on material directly. And the purpose for that is that when we bring the lunar samples back to Earth, we don't want to expose them to the Earth's atmosphere for a while. They've lived in a very good vacuum for a long period of time, so we want to keep them in a vacuum because we think they may change their characteristics some. They may oxidize or change composition if we expose them to air.
The National Space Agency, as I understand it, has made every effort to share the findings from the lunar surface with the rest of the world. Would you just briefly outline how some of the other scientists of the world are being brought into these investigations and how the organization of this is set up?
Yes, about 3 to 4 years ago, NASA put out an announcement of flight opportunities, which was an invitation for all scientists to participate in this program. And the thought then was to have scientists send in proposals to NASA to be evaluated by committees of scientists, mostly people outside the organization from universities and other agencies, to select the best scientific investigations and have the scientists selected by this process then be given lunar material, assuming we come back with the right kind of stuff from the surface to do their job. Now, through that competitive evaluation proposal routine, several hundred proposals have been investigated, and 142 scientists are now chosen as principal investigators to work on the first set of samples. We assume there'll probably be some more added for the second mission and later on missions. This 142 scientists now includes people from many universities, from several industrial labs, from other government agencies, and about 30 from abroad.
In some of the reaction we have had to the flight of Apollo 11, French President Georges Pompidou said American science has achieved one of mankind's greatest dreams. And Japanese Prime Minister Eisaku Sato expressed confidence that the achievement means further progress towards the dawn of a real space age for all mankind. And of course, the mission itself is far from over. The scientific experiments set upon the moon by astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin already are working. One is a super-sensitive moonquake detector, and ground control says it has received readings that apparently were vibrations caused by the astronauts walking. Mission Control in Houston reports that Armstrong appears to be sleeping somewhat fitfully, apparently due to exhilaration over the moonwalk. There is no data on Aldrin. Aboard the command ship in lunar orbit, crewman Michael Collins is in a deep sleep. The lunar orbiter has been on the surface of the moon now some 16 hours, 21 and a half minutes. And in a little less than 5 hours, Armstrong and Aldrin will fire the ascent engine, which must propel them to rendezvous with the command ship. Then, if all goes well, the trio sets course for home and splashdown in the mid-Pacific on Thursday. And as Merle War has said, that's only the beginning. You're listening to the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the mission of Apollo 11. This program is originating in Washington.
A color photograph of the three Apollo 11 astronauts is available in limited supply for our VOA listeners. We will send you one if you write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is the Voice of America. We'll return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news.
American military authorities in Saigon reported only one significant ground action Sunday, an infantry clash with a North Vietnamese.